can you explain us what you have meant in your paper? What's wrong with copyright protection?
Oh, what's wrong with copy? I actually call it copy prevention rather than copy protection, because I can't really figure out how it's protecting us or what it's protecting us from. So copy prevention just means, you know, equipment or software that won't let you make a copy of something, even though it's perfectly capable of making the copy, but somebody somewhere has decided they don't want you to make one. And I first encountered this with my mini disc recorder when I recorded my brother's wedding ceremony, and I wanted to make copies of it for the family. I tried to make digital copies to other people who had mini discs, and it wouldn't let me copy them. I could make one generation of copies, but the copy they received wasn't as good as the copy I had, because if mine ever got lost, theirs could never be reproduced any further. I thought it was a bit odd that my equipment was deciding for me whether or not I could record a family function. You know, and the reason for this is because Hollywood, the record industry, threatened to sue Sony when they introduced the mini disc, saying, oh, people are going to use this for something illegal. Here, stick this thing in and then we won't sue you. And they stuck it in. But it restricts a lot more than just illegal activities.
And the next thing is now to bring copy protection to computers, like in the past with the mini disc. What's your opinion about digital rights management, trusted computing? And do you think it will be successful at the end?
Well, no one knows whether it will be successful. And that's the reason they're trying it, and we are trying other paths, to see what the public really wants. Right? I don't see that there's much in it for the public in digital rights management. It's a way for producers to restrict what you can do with your computer, with your music, with your video, whether it's video that you shot or video that you're projecting, showing on your monitor. They now have digital rights management for high resolution HDTV monitors, because they're afraid people will record copyrighted movies off of them. But it also has the effect of making it impossible to show HD movies on monitors that people have already bought, that don't have this protection. They turn off the high resolution. You can only see it in low res. Well, if this is the sort of thing you as a consumer want to buy, then there's not much hope for us opponents of DRM, because the industry is certainly in favor of all sorts of things that give them more control over their user base. But if the public decides that they're not interested in buying restricted products that won't let them plug together with each other, that won't let them do obvious things in their lives that they think they want to do, instead they buy products that don't restrict their copying, like open source products, then DRM won't stand a chance. So it's not up to me, it's not up to you whether DRM succeeds or not, it's up to the public. They're willing to put up with restrictions, you know, industry will be happy to foist as many restrictions as the public will put up with. What I've been trying to do is offer them an alternative that has no restrictions, or very, very limited restrictions on what you can do with the software, or with the results of that you record with that software, or write with that software, or communicate with that software.
So, let's talk about free software. You have now 20 years of experience with free software, or is it more or less?
Yeah, it was sometime in the 80s. It was like 85, maybe 84, 83, when Richard Stallman had started the Free Software Foundation, and written his first project was to write GNU Emacs. He needed an editor with which to write the rest of the system, and so he wrote Emacs, and I helped to port it to the Sun. So I was working at Sun at the time. He had written it on a VAX and did some minor assistance there, and then just got into conversations with him. So anyway, started a company in 1989. We saw that free software was good at that point. We didn't have the, you know, tens of thousands of free packages running around that we do now. But the software we did have was a pretty solid replacement for some core functions of Unix, like the compilers and the kernel. And anyway, I started Cygnus support, later called Cygnus Solutions and later acquired by Red Hat, to sell commercial support for free software. The GNU development tools, the C compiler and the debugger and the linker. And what we discovered is it wasn't hard to make money from free software. Most of the customers didn't actually care whether the software was free or not. What they cared was that it worked, that it solved the problem they were trying to solve. And if you offered a deal that was as good as or better than what other people selling proprietary software were offering, then they'd be happy to buy it from you. And for some, you know, for some of the customers, maybe 20%, it's being free also provided them some benefits other than the standard ones. For example, a lot of people who used our free software were chip companies. They would invent a new processor chip and they'd need compilers for it. And so we'd build them the compilers in exchange for a significant amount of money. And then they could give away those compilers to anybody who might want to buy their chip. And this is a good deal for the people who are trying out their chip.
Did you ever expect it that free software will get so big as it is now in these 20 years?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, of course it's hard to predict anything more than about 5 years out in computers. Even the best people with the longest vision say like, everything changes so much in 5 years. Hard to go beyond it, but so I couldn't say I'd predict 20 years worth of this stuff, but it was clear that free software had powerful advantages, at least for people who have any experience with software. And it was sort of like I was on the ARPANET. I stumbled onto the ARPANET in the 1980s through a contractor who came to work at where I was working. And it was clear that having email, and the network in those days had maybe 60 computers on it. It was connecting up Stanford and MIT and various Pentagon places and a few places overseas, University College London and such. And it was clear having email that worked and having mailing lists and being able to immediately log into computers anywhere else in the world and stuff like that had real positive, useful benefits. And we're always kind of waiting, like, what took everybody else so long to figure out that they wanted to be on email too, you know, or they wanted to have a web or whatever. But I think it was just that the price of computers had to come down before it became possible for anybody to have a computer in their pocket or, you know, on the desk at home or whatever, and use it this way. So, Now that we've got powerful, complicated computers coming out of our ears, free software is more important than ever because it can be so easily adapted to work in new environments. As we keep inventing new portable computing environments, people keep putting Linux on them, and they keep putting BSDs on them, they keep putting microkernels, and somehow they all run Bash. And they all run IP networking, they all run IP packets, oh, probably over Ethernet at some bottom layer. Right, so that gives us a lot of, having 20, 30 years worth of mature software that uses that kind of infrastructure gives us a really good lever to applying the new things to solve whatever problem we're trying to solve.
So, now the way of free software is going to other places like Wikipedia. Have you ever written something in Wikipedia?
Yes, I wrote an entry in Wikipedia. Well, I didn't write one from scratch. I found what happened was I was reading a Supreme Court decision from the United States that that EFF people had commented on. So I went off to read what the judges had actually written, because they're usually pretty good writers. And there was a footnote in it that pointed out to a Wikipedia entry. And it was the entry for the color-coded Homeland Defense System that the U.S. Homeland Security Department has put out to warn people of the danger of a terrorist attack. And the system, you know, has five colors, and they've only ever used two of them. The one that says, be worried but pliable, you know, and the one that says, be really worried and give up all your rights. And apparently there is no condition that will ever cause the threat level to be reduced to ordinary. Like, oh no, it's just another day in life. But anyway, it occurred to me that a lot of people would be going to read that entry very soon, because this was a Supreme Court decision that had just come out. So I went there and looked at it to see if it was accurate, and it wasn't. You know, it described the basic structure of the system, but it didn't really describe the public reaction to it. So I amended the article to talk about this and submitted that. And somebody reverted my changes, saying that they were biased. And indeed, they were. You know, and I read my way around Wikipedia about conflict resolution and the neutral point of view and blah, blah, blah. And went back and edited my thing to comply with the standards they had published, and then it stuck. And it's been in there more or less the same. A few people have tweaked little things in it, but it's been there the same ever since.
Do you know the cooperation between KDE and Wikipedia, which has started now? They started now a cooperation to get content from Wikipedia into every free software program you can imagine. So if you are using Amarok, the KDE media player, you can get the band information or the record information straight from Wikipedia.
Right.
And say, release the cooperation at the Linux Tag. So it's very new, and they are starting and doing experience with it, but
it's a nice idea.
A way to connect two free worlds together, the software world and the content world, and we are just at the beginning of these things. What do you think about getting connected, free content, free software, creating a free world as an alternative to digital rights management?
It sounds like the answer is already embedded in the question.
Okay,
yeah. I think it's great that people are licensing things other than software on free terms, and being concrete about what the free terms are. And that's really enabling other people to repurpose it to do all kinds of things. You know, who would have expected that a Wikipedia page would end up in a media player? But why not? It's actually, it's a good thing.
Okay, and so we have the free world, we have the upcoming digital rights management world. A lot of people read the debate or follow the debate. But what can people do to protect the free world, to protect digital rights and all the stuff?
Well, the first thing is just to be aware of what restrictions are in the products that are around you. Whether you're using one, whether you're buying or thinking of buying one, or whether you're building one. Okay, so what are the restrictions in the other products like this? What are the restrictions in the one you're using, and how do you, you know, what do you want to do about that? So awareness, and second, the manufacturers who are putting digital rights management into their products, it's never in the ads. They never say, new digital rights management now restricts how many places you can play the songs you downloaded from iTunes. Right? So we have to publicize these restrictions, because the manufacturers will hush them up. Their whole strategy is for people to buy these products not knowing they're restricted and not ever being bitten by the restrictions until they have snuffed out the ability to compete with them, and at that point they can turn the restrictions on and people won't have an alternative to go to. So I think that has to be the strategy of Hollywood, is to eliminate their competition by law, which, for example, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, is intended to outlaw the traditional practice of previous generations of technology, which is, if there was a media product that people wanted to interface to a computer, they would figure out how to interface it, and they'd build an interface, and then you could read and write the thing, or at least read it initially, and usually eventually read-write. Well, they made that illegal for DVDs. So now they've outlawed the ability to produce an open source media player that has the features that you wanted instead of the features Hollywood wants it. And luckily there are still free countries left on Earth where people can publish such things without being, you know, having their websites taken down and getting tossed in jail. So most people know how to download one. But you can't ship them in a Linux distribution in the States. You can't ship a DVD player. And so publicizing what the restrictions are, and trying to, when you make a product, make a conscious decision rather than an unconscious decision about what kind of restrictions to put into it, and what kind of auto-updating features also. A lot of people are putting out products that update themselves automatically, or with a trivial command like Debian. And the problem with that is that things that aren't improvements can get slipped in to an awful lot of people's machines quickly. It's sort of a great transmission channel for people who are trying to take over and do something nefarious. So keep an eye on, you know, what versions of software you're running on your machine, and it's always been my practice to try to have the source code that matches the binaries. Right? This is easiest to do if you buy distributions on CD, because you can buy ones that come with the matching source code. If you're updating over the net, you actually, I don't know of a tool that automatically brings you and archives the source when you bring in new binary updates. But it seems to me that would be a good tool for someone to write or enhance the existing tools. Plus, with disk space, as cheap as it is, you know, there's no reason not to have full source code for your operating system. There's so many versions and variations around, you really like to have the one that matches what you're running in case you run into a problem and need expert help at debugging it.
Okay, I see. That's all?
Sure.
So we can go to lunch?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure rambling for you.